This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Mad cow disease and foot and mouth disease might have you thinking more about vegetables. My guest Jack Bishop has plenty of suggestions for making vegetable dishes that are delicious, and he has advice on buying and storing vegetables. Bishop is the author of the new cookbook, Vegetables Every Day. He writes about food for the New York Times, Cooks Illustrated, and Natural Health magazine. His other books include The Complete Italian Vegetarian Cookbook and Lasagna. Although he's not a vegetarian, he says that vegetables are the heart of all meals in his home. I asked him what he loves about them.
I think my favorite thing about vegetables is the connection that you have with the seasons. I mean, if you eat pasta, if you eat chicken, it's pretty much the same 365 days of the year. Pasta is pasta, chicken is chicken. But when you walk into the produce market, the vegetable aisle at the supermarket, you never know exactly what you're going to find. And there's that element of surprise that you stumble upon something that looks absolutely wonderful that you just have to take home and do something with. There's also the connection to the season. And I think we've certainly lost that to a certain extent with mass production of vegetables all around the world and being able to enjoy many vegetables 12 months of the year. But I think especially if you shop at farm stands or places that are really focusing on local produce, it allows you to sort of stay in tune with those natural rhythms.
Let's talk about some of the best basic ways of preparing vegetables. And why don't we start with grilling? Because I think that's becoming an increasingly popular way of doing vegetables, and it's got a really interesting taste and texture if you grill them.
Well, one of the things I like about grilling is what you're doing is it's a dry heat that is causing moisture in the vegetables to be lost. So what you're really doing is concentrating the flavor. I mean, if you think about asparagus and if you were to boil it, you're sort of losing a lot of the flavor of the vegetable to the water, and then you pour the water down the sink. But if you were to lightly oil the asparagus, maybe sprinkle it with some coarse salt and throw it on the grill, you are concentrating the flavor of the vegetables. The sort of natural sweetness and sugars in the vegetables come to the forefront. You get that sort of lightly crisp exterior, which adds tons of flavor as well as texture. And almost any vegetable can be put on the grill. And I think as more and more people do their cooking of other things, whether it's the meat, the fish, the chicken on the grill, it just makes total sense to then do the vegetables on the grill as well.
Say you're grilling zucchini. How would you oil them so that they don't stick to the grill? But on the other hand, so that they don't get too oily.
I usually just put the vegetables in a bowl, drizzle no more than a tablespoon of oil, and then use my hands. They're the best tool to make sure that you've completely coated all the surfaces. They just have to be very, very lightly coated. As you said, you just want to prevent them from sticking. There's no reason to add more oil than is absolutely necessary. If you don't want to get your hands dirty, you can certainly put them on a baking tray and use a pastry brush and brush the oil lightly over the surface. But I find it more effective and quicker to just get in there and use my hands.
What kind of oil do you recommend for grilling or for stir frying?
Well, when I'm grilling, I really like to use olive oil. I think in all of my cooking, I feel like if you're going to add oil to food, it maybe should bring something besides just fat, and I want some flavor. So I use extra virgin olive oil. I think it has a wonderful flavor that complements almost all the vegetables. And when I stir fry, I use a roasted peanut oil, not a highly refined peanut oil, but one that may say roasted or toasted peanut oil. And when you open the bottle of the oil, it actually smells like freshly roasted peanuts, and it just adds a wonderful flavor to a stir fry.
What are the advantages of stir frying vegetables?
Well, stir-fry vegetables, you get sort of concentrated flavors that we were talking about that you get from the grill, but you also get a sauce there. And I think that that's, you know, part of the appeal. You can add anything. You can add orange juice and fermented black beans. You could add lemon and ginger. And so you're cooking and saucing the vegetable at the same time, and it's a sort of neat way of combining two processes in one.
What do you think of steaming vegetables?
Steaming vegetables is a nice alternative to boiling, which is a method that my mother used a lot, and I wish she had done more steaming when I was a kid because it really preserves the texture and flavor better of the vegetables. But once the vegetable is steamed, you really do need to do something to it. Steamed broccoli, steamed green beans are a bit bland on their own and really need a really highly flavorful vinaigrette or some other sort of sauce to perk them up to make them extremely palatable.
Jack Bishop is my guest. His new book is called Vegetables Every Day. It's a guide to buying and cooking vegetables. Well, let's talk a little bit about perhaps the most loved of vegetables in America, the potato. Mr. Popularity. You have a good alternative to French fries in your book. It's oven fries.
I love oven fries. I mean, it's one of those things I do not feel guilty feeding my children oven fries. If they want them 5 nights a week, I'm happy to provide them 5 nights a week. In addition to the much reduced mess, I mean, there's nothing like deep-fried French fried potatoes, but you really don't want to be doing it every day. And to oven fry, there's just a couple of tricks that you want to use. You want to make sure that you've got the oven really nice and hot. 425 is a reasonable temperature to start out at. And you want to make sure that you've cut the potatoes into fairly long wedges. I usually cut the potato lengthwise into 8 or 10 pieces. And you've got to oil them lightly and let the baking sheet preheat in the oven, so that when the oven comes up to temperature, you pull up out the baking sheet, you throw the potatoes on, and they immediately start to sizzle. Let them turn just once during the process. You want them to get a nice golden brown crust. And after about 40, 50 minutes, they're going to be absolutely perfect.
So you just leave them in the oven, turn them once, and it's...
Just turn them once. I mean, I think a lot of times people try to turn them too often, and they end up not getting that nice golden brown crust on them. So I let them go at least 25 minutes. Turn them, a pair of tongs works nicely. Turn each piece, get it on another side that's not brown, and then another 15 to 25 minutes, depending on the size of the potatoes, and you've got perfectly cooked, nice, crisp oven fries. And you can probably cook 2 pounds of potatoes with maybe 2 tablespoons of oil, which is really not that much when you're talking about serving 4 or 6 people.
Do you have a good suggestion for improving on your basic microwaved baked potato? It gets the job done, the microwave, but not in a very interesting way.
I gotta say, it's one of the unkindest things you can do to your poor potato is to put it in the microwave. And certainly if you are pressed for time, to turn on the oven to 450, cook the potato in the microwave halfway, and then transfer it to the oven. I mean, my feeling is that a potato that's cooked strictly in the microwave is just going to be very soggy and flabby, and that you could cut the cooking time drastically if you start it in the microwave and then finish it in the hot oven so that the exterior can crisp up and more steam can escape. But really, the oven the entire time is the best way to cook the potato.
How long would you be doing it in your technique if you were just doing the second half in the oven?
I would say about 15 minutes.
That doesn't sound too bad.
No, it's not too bad. And honestly, you think, oh, it's going to take 45 minutes or an hour to bake a potato completely in the oven. But if you just put that in and do that first, as soon as you walk in the door, odds are it's going to take you that long to sort of unwind, get ready to really start cooking. And you can probably time it so that the potatoes come out of the oven just as dinner's ready.
Let's get to one of the more controversial vegetables, and I'm thinking of broccoli. Some people just really think of themselves as hating broccoli. Why do you think some people find broccoli so offensive?
Well, the broccoli has a very unusual chemical compound that once the broccoli is cooked more than about 7 or 8 minutes in boiling water, this sulfur smell just becomes overpowering. And the broccoli really is pretty... I would say, I don't want to say disgusting, but it almost can become so that inedible if you overcook it, besides losing the texture and becoming mushy and becoming that horrible drab gray color. So I think a lot of people, you know, they think of broccoli they had in the cafeteria line at school that was probably cooked for 20 minutes and just say, oh, I can't possibly fathom actually buying broccoli myself and making it. But as long as you make sure not to cook the broccoli much more than about 5 minutes, I think it's got a wonderful flavor. I think broccoli can even be sweet. And I think that, you know, strong flavored vinaigrettes and sauces. I mean, I love to do a little spicy balsamic dressing with black olives. So I just steam the broccoli, comes out of the pan. I toss it in a bowl with vinaigrette with the balsamic vinegar, hot red pepper flakes, a little garlic, some red wine vinegar, some olive oil, and some pitted and sliced kalamatas. And it's a really great counterpoint to the broccoli flavor.
Give us another suggestion, too, for like a really simple way of preparing tasty broccoli.
Well, the other way is a stir fry. I think that broccoli with a sort of sesame stir fry, which is a Chinese restaurant classic, is remarkably easy. And I just saute the broccoli till it's sort of bright green. And then I'll add a sauce with a little soy sauce, a little sesame seeds, maybe some garlic, some ginger. Throw the cover on the pan to trap some of the heat and the moisture and to really cook the broccoli through and let that sauce reduce down a little bit. And you've got a great quick stir fry.
And one of the problems about broccoli is that it's kind of hard to digest. It can cause a lot of intestinal gas. Do you have any suggestions for making it easier on the stomach?
The suggestion is frequency of eating. I mean, with broccoli, with legumes, which give some people problems. I mean, I see all these things out there that you can add to your food, and they might work, they might not, I'm not sure. But I found that the more you eat these things, the more your system becomes accustomed to them. So that if you have broccoli once a month, odds are, and if broccoli gives you problems, it's probably going to continue to give you problems. And there's not a lot you can do in the cooking process that's going to reduce that. But if you eat broccoli on a regular basis along with legumes and all these other things, your system will learn to tolerate them. Even if you think that that won't happen, it really will.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jack Bishop. He's a food writer who writes for several magazines and the New York Times. His new book is called Vegetables Every Day. Let's take a short break here, and then we'll talk more about buying and cooking vegetables. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jack Bishop. He writes about food for several magazines and for the New York Times. His new book is called Vegetables Every Day. Let's talk about carrots. You know, you said that carrots have more natural sugar than any vegetable except beets. And I figured, oh, no wonder I use carrots so much when I'm preparing dinner. It must be the sugar.
It is the sugar. I mean, that's the reason why kids like carrots. They have that sweetness. But I think, you know, the carrots are pretty rock hard and people think, oh, well, I might nibble on some carrot sticks. But they think in terms of cooking carrots, there are very few things that people do. You know, they sort of do that sugared glazed carrots if they do anything with carrots. And I think that the flavor and that sweetness lends itself to so many treatments. I mean, one of my favorite things to do is to just peel the carrots, cut them into small dice, maybe half inch pieces, and then boil them till they're tender but not mushy, maybe 8 or 9 minutes. Drain the carrots and then toss them with a light vinaigrette. I mean, I might do something with North African spices that's got a little olive oil, lemon juice, some sweet paprika, some cumin, some cinnamon, and then a final flourish of some parsley or cilantro. And you can take the same idea and do Indian spices, Asian spices, and it's a really lovely side dish with a roast chicken, most anything. And it's one of those things that people say, oh, carrots. I never knew you could do that with carrots. As I said, you know, that sort of maple glazed or honey glazed carrot seems to be the only thing people know, and they think, oh, it's a holiday dish. But I think carrots you can do so much more with.
Yeah, the problem I find with like the honeyed carrots is if carrots are already sweet, why make them sweeter? Why not use the sweetness as a counterpoint to something else?
Well, right. And that's why I think the spices work really nicely. I mean, this to do curry or to do some Szechuan peppercorns, to sort of take it in a different direction. I mean, I think that maple glazed carrot is, you know, it's a holiday thing where all you do is do sweetness and you're thinking that turkey and you keep adding sweet elements to the meal. But that's really something you only want to do once a year. And in sort of day-to-day cooking, it's better to play off the sweetness and come up with a foil for it.
Let's move on to tomatoes. I think tomatoes are a great cause of frustration now. It is so difficult to find a tomato with any taste to it. And I think that's become true even in the summer, unless you have access to a really good farmer's market. I've just been finding that even from the farmer's markets, tomatoes don't taste the way they used to.
It's really true. I mean, the tomato has really been subjected to all kinds of indignities, including, you know, trying to produce a decent tomato for supermarkets in January, which is a fool's errand that no one will ever succeed at. But I have a couple of strategies besides the just, you know, buying a local tomato, which is always going to be your best bet. Cherry tomatoes, I think, are actually not so bad, and I like to sauté them. The little bit of heat, maybe 2 or 3 minutes in a hot skillet, releases some of their juices and really makes them much more appealing. And at other times of the year where you feel like the large tomatoes just are not going to have any flavor, but you really have a hankering for some tomatoes, try some of the cherry tomatoes and simply just cut them in half, or if they're very small, leave them whole and sauté them in a little olive oil. You can finish with garlic and basil, with a little olives and feta cheese. And it's a really sort of nice alternative, especially if you want to cook the tomatoes.
You use canned tomatoes when you're cooking, too.
whenever I'm doing a dish where the tomatoes are an ingredient as opposed to making a tomato salad or a tomato side dish, I use canned tomatoes. And I just love the canned tomatoes from California. They're picked ripe, which you could, it's not the case with most of the fresh tomatoes you see in the supermarket, which are picked green and then shipped that way. And they just have that sweet summer flavor. I buy the organic tomatoes, and I think they're just wonderful. And I use them in all of my pasta sauces and any of my cooking where I want the tomatoes to be an ingredient. And they're incredibly convenient. I buy the diced canned tomatoes, which are simply whole tomatoes packed in some juice. And they've got just fabulous flavor and no preparation time.
So how do you use them? Give us a good recipe.
I make my standard tomato sauce. It starts with the canned tomatoes. And I will just warm some olive oil and some garlic in a saucepan. Add the tomatoes. Let it simmer just about 10 minutes. The longer you cook the tomatoes, I find that the less flavor they have. You're really trying to preserve that sort of fresh, sweet flavor. So you just cook it long enough to thicken the sauce. You can finish with some basil. You can finish with another herb. And it's the simplest tomato sauce. And it makes me wonder why anyone would open a jar of tomato sauce, which has, you know, been cooked forever and honestly has almost no tomato flavor, when you can make your own tomato sauce in 10 minutes.
Jack Bishop is my guest. He's a food writer who has a new book called Vegetables Every Day. Portobello mushrooms have really caught on. And I mean, in restaurants, you can even find portobello mushroom sandwiches on many menus. What do you do with portobellos?
I love to do an open-faced sandwich with the portobellos. It's really, I guess, what you would call a bruschetta as opposed to a sandwich. But I grill a big, nice, thick piece of country bread. You can do it in the toaster, under the broiler, it doesn't matter. I then, for the first layer, I take some white beans and mash them up and saute them in a little oil and garlic with some oregano. Put that layer on. Then I put some wilted spinach. Just throw it in the pan. Let it just soften up a little bit. And then I put a grilled portobello mushroom on top. And the juices from the mushroom soak down through the spinach into the beans. And it's, you know, one of these things you have to eat with a knife and fork. There's no way you're going to be able to use your hands because it's way too messy. But it's just absolutely delicious with the contrasting textures and flavors.
That sounds really good.
It is really good.
What do you look for when you're buying portobello mushrooms?
Well, you just want to make sure that they smell right, which I know sounds like an odd thing when you're buying a mushroom, but you really want to smell the mushroom. It should smell clean, mildly earthy, no sour or acrid odors at all, and certainly not, in terms of appearance, any softness. If you see the underside where those black gills are and you see any sliminess, it's definitely means you should, you know, move on and look for another mushroom.
When you're cooking regular mushrooms, you know, when you're doing whatever it is you're going to do with them, do you peel them first?
I never peel them. I can't be bothered. And I don't take the damp paper towel either. I sometimes, if they're really dirty, just wash them, which I know is a bit of a heresy. People say, oh, you can't ever wash a mushroom. You need to use a brush and clean each one. But I find that as long as you wash them and then immediately cook them, it's fine.
You've survived.
I have survived. The mushrooms have not become horribly soggy. It's true that if you wash mushrooms and let them sit around for a while, they'll sort of almost disintegrate before your eyes and become a sort of soft mass. But as long as you wash them and cook them immediately, it's fine.
Do you have any really easy-to-make vegetable sauces that are truly quick and easy?
Well, in terms of sauces, I think most vegetables will do better with an oil-based vinaigrette than those heavy egg-based, cream-based sauces of yesteryear, you know, the hollandaise that was also popular when I was a kid. And I think just really simple vinaigrettes, a little olive oil, some an acid ingredient, whether that's lemon juice, orange juice, a vinegar, a fresh herb, not a dried herb, a fresh herb, and you've got enough to sort of give a flavor boost. And you can sort of take it from there, and you can add a little bit of shallot, you can add a little bit of garlic, you can go get more complex and start adding spices to it. But at its base, that's where I would start.
Do you ever use salad dressings, like prepared salad dressings? Well, you probably don't.
I know. You know what? I lived in Italy, and I often don't even make salad dressing. What I do with my salad probably 3 nights out of 4 is I get the bottle of vinegar out and just lightly drizzle it over the salad bowl. I lightly drizzle the extra virgin olive oil over the salad. I take a teeny, teeny pinch of coarse salt, kosher salt, a couple grindings of black pepper, 2 forks, and I toss it. And I've dressed my salad. I haven't made salad dressing, but the salad is absolutely wonderful. And when you do that method, as opposed to combining the vinegar and oil in a separate bowl and then drizzling that mixture over the salad, you actually taste the vinegar and you taste the oil more clearly. So if you've got a really nice balsamic vinegar or really nice sherry vinegar, it's a great way to dress your salad.
Jack Bishop is the author of the new cookbook, Vegetables Every Day. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jack Bishop, author of the new book, Vegetables Every Day, a guide to buying, storing, and preparing vegetables. Bishop also writes about food for the New York Times, Cooks Illustrated, and Natural Health magazine. What do you like to do with collard greens?
I'm not a Southerner. I'm a Northerner. So I come from the school of I'd rather not cook collards for an hour, which seems to be all the sort of classic Southern recipes. But on the other hand, I don't want the collards to be crunchy. I mean, collards are pretty tough, and you want to cook them long enough so that they're no longer tough. One of my sort of adaptation of a Southern-style recipe is to wash the greens real well and leave them a little bit damp, throw them in a big casserole or a Dutch oven with some salt, and let them cook down maybe 15 or 20 minutes so that they're soft and tender, but they haven't completely dissolved. And then in another skillet, I'm just sautéing a little bit of onion. If you want to add some bacon, you can add some bacon. Stir that into the greens. Finish it with some vinegar. I like to use red wine vinegar. I think the greens really need to be offset with some acidity and a little black pepper. And it's a really nice way to serve the collards.
Bitter greens like radicchio and endive have become very popular in a lot of restaurants now. You suggest that we think of those greens not only as salad ingredients, but as vegetables to cook. Would you recommend a recipe?
With endive, I love to braise it, which means that I will cut it in half lengthwise through that little core end. And then I will heat a little butter or oil in a sauté pan that's large enough to hold all the endive in a single layer. Then I'll add the endive to the hot pan with the cut side down and let it cook just till it's nicely browned. I'll flip it over, brown the other side, and then I'll add a liquid to the pan. You can use stock. You could use juice. One of my favorite things to do is to use apple cider. Maybe 1/2 cup, 2/3 cup of apple cider. Throw in a little fresh thyme. Cover the pan. Reduce the heat. Let it cook about 15 minutes just until the endive is tender. It's absolutely delicious. And the reason why I like the cider there is, again, that sweet and bitter works really well together. And it's a great side dish.
How about radicchio?
Radicchio, what I do is I cut through the core end again. You want the pieces, the wedges, to stay intact. And I cut, depending on the size, into 6 or 8 wedges through the core end. Lightly oil them, and they're wonderful on the grill. The outside kind of chars a little bit. And you get a little bit of that grill flavor, which works real nicely with the bitterness of the radicchio, and just a little salt and pepper, and that's all I do to the radicchio, and it's wonderful.
Do you usually use radicchio and endive in your salads?
I use them in salads all the time, but as I say, I think it's really nice to think of them as vegetables because they really are vegetables.
Mm-hmm.
And in salads, you can only use small amounts. I think that their flavors are pretty potent, and I always want to balance them with a tender, soft lettuce that's milder in flavor so that it's just not so overpowering. But when you cook them, whether you're cooking the endive with some cider or you're grilling the radicchio, you take a little bit of that sharpness off and you really can eat the vegetable. You can have a whole head of radicchio or a whole spear of endive and not feel like you've had this incredible bitter flavor.
In a lot of neighborhoods, we're lucky we get vegetables that are from other regions or even from other countries. What are some of the things you've been finding in markets near you that you didn't see in earlier decades that you've enjoyed using?
Well, I think that's one of the most exciting things about vegetable preparation is all of these once exotic things which have become almost commonplace in supermarkets. All these Latin root vegetables, the yuca, the malanga, the taro, Asian things, ingredients, bok choy, which is almost a staple in my house. It's bok choy is a leafy cabbage, green cabbage, that's used in Chinese cooking. And it just has a wonderful flavor. I think it's a little sweeter than most of the cabbages we're used to. And I just love it.
You have some nice things to say about plantains, which are kind of like bananas, but they're not. Where do they come from? What do they taste like?
Plantains look like a banana, except if you peer real closely, you'll notice that instead of sort of being perfectly cylindrical, they've got ridges on them, usually three ridges. And they vary in color from green all the way to black. And in fact, the black plantains, in terms of the skin color, are the sweetest and the best, although none of them are really sweet in the way you would consider a regular banana. They're starchy, almost like a potato, but they can have a floral, fruity flavor that's subtle but present. And the flesh, instead of that whitish, creamish color of a banana, often has a tinge of orange, and it's just absolutely beautiful. And I think plantains are wonderful on the grill. They're wonderful in the oven. I sometimes, instead of a baked potato, will take a plantain, one that's either yellowish black or black on the outside. I will prick it just like I prick a potato to let some steam escape and put it in a hot oven, 425, for maybe 20 minutes until it's tender. And then I will slit the plantain in half. And then instead of the mashed potato sort of sour cream and butter route, I'll do something a little bit more tropical. And I'll do lime wedges, maybe a little Tabasco salt sauce, a little salt. And it's a really lovely change of pace from a baked potato.
What should you look for when you're buying a plantain?
Well, it depends how you want to cook the plantain. If you want to fry the plantain or make plantain chips, you want a plantain that's green and rock hard. If you're going to bake the plantain, if you're going to saute the plantain, if you're going to grill it, you want that outside skin to be yellowish black or completely black, which will indicate that the plantain is not overly starchy and has a little bit of sweetness.
How do you store vegetables in your refrigerator so that they don't get soggy?
The problem I think that a lot of people have is they take those bags from the supermarket and then they knot them or they seal them.
The plastic bags.
Those plastic bags. And basically you're creating a little greenhouse with, you know, they're spraying all the vegetables with those automatic sprayers, which isn't necessarily a bad thing. But if you then put that sort of damp vegetable in a sealed bag, you've created a greenhouse and it's going to soften much, much more quickly. The plastic bags are fine. Just don't seal them. And you can even sort of poke a couple holes in them if you want to. If you notice when you get home, if you've bought spinach or another leafy green and it's really wet, you might want to take it out of that damp plastic bag. And sometimes even water will collect in the bottom of the bag. And just put it in a dry bag. You can even towel off a little extra moisture, because that moisture is really what's going to cause the vegetable to go downhill.
You have children. You know, the old joke is I can't get my kids to eat their vegetables. Do your kids like vegetables?
The vegetables they like, they really like, and the rest of the vegetables, it's like I'm trying to feed them poison. So we stick with the broccoli, the green beans, the asparagus. Both of my kids seem to like vegetables that they can sort of pick up, and the asparagus particularly is an absolute favorite. They just think, I think, as much because of the shape as the flavor, that asparagus is the most fun thing to eat. And, you know, occasionally they'll see a vegetable that my wife and I are eating, and one of them will say, you know, they want a taste. They get a taste. Sometimes they like it and they've discovered a new vegetable. But, you know, you really can't push it. The important thing is you want your kids to try to develop a couple of vegetables they'll reliably eat. And if they want to have broccoli three nights a week, that's fine by me.
Well, one thing I think I learned is that I should go over to your house for dinner. Do you cook a lot? It sure sounds like you do.
I'm cooking all the time. Probably half of the day I'm cooking, and then, of course, I'm cooking always dinner, whether or not I'm sort of developing recipes. You know, I've got two kids, and my wife usually relies upon me to do the cooking, so it's my job to sort of get dinner on the table every night. And it's, you know, one of the sort of real joys in my sort of daily routine. I mean, I think people always say to me, oh, the frozen vegetables or the bagged vegetables, they're always so easy. At the end of the day, I find nothing more relaxing than to turn on the radio and to get out a knife or a vegetable peeler and just start preparing some vegetables. It's a way to sort of unwind, to sort of collect your thoughts. You're preparing the rest of the meal. And I sort of look forward with pleasure whether it's I'm peeling carrots or I'm washing some spinach, it's a task that I derive a lot of pleasure from, as to look at it as a chore.
A lot of what you've described to us in today's interview sounds like vegetable side dishes, but you often eat vegetarian meals. What's a good vegetarian main dish that you can suggest for us?
Well, I think in terms of vegetarian main dishes, you want to, the easiest way I think for most Americans to think about it is to team up with a starch, and pasta is sort of obvious alternative. So a lot of dishes that you might think of as a vegetable side dish of wilted spinach that's got garlic and ginger in it can quickly become a sauce that's really just more than a it's not a tomato sauce. It's sort of taking pasta to a whole new level. If I've got some wilted spinach that I've cooked in a pan with some ginger and garlic, and I cook up some soba noodles or maybe some Chinese noodles, and it's a great, really simple vegetarian entree. And I think that's sort of the easiest way to get into it. I mean, you can start talking about beans, vegetable casseroles, and things that are a little bit more elaborate, but that's a really simple way to start.
You talked about teaming up vegetables with a starch. What about with protein?
You know, this protein issue, I feel like protein has gotten the biggest boost in the last couple of years from various diet books. I eat protein during the course of my day, but I don't think that you need to have protein at every meal, in every morsel that you're eating. Every plate does not need to have protein on it, and you will be completely fine. And I'm pretty sure most of the nutritionists out there agree with me. So that if you want to have a vegetarian meal, first of all, there's protein in pasta, not a whole lot, but certainly enough. You know, you're going to have a tuna salad, a turkey sandwich for lunch. You're going to get your protein in other places, and certainly to mix it up so that you do get protein from beans one night if you're going to have vegetarian, the soy foods, the tofus and tempehs. But there's no reason to think, oh my God, there's no protein on the plate. I'm going to suddenly start my body to fall apart. It's, again, everything sort of in moderation. And that as long as you sort of don't get into one single rut and work in as many foods as possible during the course of a week, which is really the way to think about your diet, not meal to meal or even day to day, but what you eat over the course of the week, you'll be fine.
Well, Jack Bishop, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry. It's been a pleasure.
Jack Bishop is the author of the new cookbook, Vegetables Every Day. This is Fresh Air.